This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is journalist Alex Steffen, co-founder and executive editor of worldchanging.com, which was founded on the idea that real solutions already exist for building the future we want. It's just a matter of grabbing hold and getting moving. Alex is here today to discuss ways to create a future which is sustainable, dynamic, prosperous, and fair, and to tell us about the book he edited titled World Changing, A User's Guide to the 21st Century, published in 2006 by Abrams, an imprint of Harry N. Abrams, Inc. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Could you begin by telling us about worldchanging.com, your history and mission?
Sure. World Changing came out of our experience, a number of us who had worked together previously as journalists and media consultants and futurists and other kinds of strategists, a lot of folks who'd spent time in social change movements and in the environmental movement, and had a feeling that while we were hearing a lot about the problems of the world, we were hearing very little about the solutions to those problems, and that hearing only about the problems can itself be disempowering, that people get overwhelmed, they turn off, they find themselves in despair. And we really wanted to try and see if there wasn't a way to talk intelligently, not blindly or, you know, or too optimistically, but intelligently and optimistically and with focus about the kinds of solutions that were unfolding. And as we started the project and got rolling with it, what we found, of course, is that there are literally millions of people out there coming up with thousands and thousands of terrific solutions that already work.
Could you say more about who else is involved with worldchanging.com?
Sure. We have a very small team. We're a little nonprofit that runs it. Our team of staff is myself, Sarah Rich, who's the managing editor, who also comes from a sustainable design background and runs as a side project in Habitat, which is another blog about sustainable design. Tessa Levine Sauerhoff, who's our editorial program director and who does arranges all our book tours and so on and so forth. And Leif Utney, whose parents founded the Utney Reader back in the day and who's our publisher. In addition, we have a large team of people all over the world, really, about 30 regular contributors and a number of correspondents in about 20 countries now who write about various solutions ranging from energy and transportation to water to urban planning to social justice movements to digital democracy to emerging technologies, really a whole spectrum of things. And that group has been phenomenally wonderful in terms of helping us find out about solutions that often even people working in those fields don't yet know about, and then bring those solutions to a wide audience. And the site's been very successful. We have about 3 million page views a month these days.
Would you give us a general overview of the topics and resources in the book?
Sure. What we did in the book is we start literally at people's doorstep. We start with the things that we use in our day-to-day lives, the products we buy, the food we eat, the cars we drive. We move from there into people's homes and talk about green building and energy and water. We move from there to talk about cities and the way cities are built, because cities are really a vital leverage point in the 21st century for building sustainability. We talk then about communities and how the people who live in specific cities can better help meet one another's needs. We move then into business, because we really believe that business is a fundamental tool for creating change now. And we then talk about politics, because democracy is how we're actually going to get to where we want to go. And we end with planet and talking about the entire solar system and helping people find resources for actually placing oneself in the physical world and in the solar system itself and understanding the big picture, if you will. And at every step along the way, what we try and do is a couple things. We start with the small steps that are easily done immediately, things that we should all be doing. We talk about then the things that are actually probably more important but a little more difficult that are available now. And then we talk about the things that aren't yet available but could be or should be. In addition, we at each step, we talk about not only the reality of our lives here in the developed world, but also what's unfolding in the developing world. Because one of the central premises of World Changing is that it's all interconnected and that we can't fix any one piece of it in isolation, that we actually need to come up with solutions that fix multiple problems for many people at the same time. And so we try and give people a sense of what, for example, are the housing, you know, not only what's green housing all about, but what are the housing needs of people who have been through a conflict situation or a natural disaster and now find themselves refugees? You know, not only how do we save water here in the Pacific Northwest, but also how do we provide clean water for the billion people who don't have safe drinking water? those sorts of questions. And our goal is that hopefully we provide really useful and, you know, inspiring and exciting information for people to use in their own lives. But then we also show how each of us is connected to the bigger picture.
How do you hope people will use the book?
Well, a lot of people have actually just been literally sitting down and reading the book cover to cover, which is astonishing to me because it's a 350,000-word book, and it's not, you know, it's, although it's very well written and we have over 70 authors involved and, you know, some of them are phenomenally brilliant people. All of them are phenomenally brilliant people. It's not exactly beach reading, but some people have just sat down and read it cover to cover. What we intended for it to be was more really an opportunity for people to skim through it, get a sense of what's in it, of the picture that's there. And then as they have questions or as they're looking for inspiration or as they have some spare moments and they want to learn a bit more about, say, water, they can go dive into it and really learn there. And there's resources on, not only there but on the website as well. The website is built to – and the website and the book are built to work together. So once you've read the book, you can go to the website and find out more about some of these things by looking for the resources there.
What are some of the best overall strategies or approaches to a more sustainable world illustrated in your book?
Well, I think that there's a couple things that we, those of us who've been working towards sustainability for some time, I think have learned some things in recent years. One of them is that we've learned that there is no sustainability that's not an urban sustainability, that we now live on an urban planet. We are increasingly urbanizing. Some people say that by 2050, 70% of all the people on the planet will be living in cities, mostly in the developing world. Some people say by 2050, it could be as much as 90% of all of humanity living in cities. So we need to figure out how to make cities work, both because we have a moral obligation to our fellow human beings to make good lives for everybody, but also because cities are really both the drivers of environmental destruction and resource use and pollution and so forth, but also the greatest leverage point to actually reduce people's ecological footprints, that well-designed cities actually help people live in a greener fashion. For example, the residents of Manhattan, if they were a state by themselves, would be the state with the lowest energy use and the lowest solid waste production. They would be the greenest people in America. Similarly, Vancouver has found, as it's grown more and more dense by bringing more housing into the inner core, that people actually drive less. The number of miles driven per Vancouverite per day is going down. We are finding that when you design cities well, people's behaviors change, and that they start to substitute efficiency and access by proximity, meaning that you walk to things, and other sort of quality of life measurements, going and sitting in a cafe, for driving long distances, having a huge lawn, living in a McMansion, having a fifth television. So that's, I think, a real breakthrough, is that we've understood that cities are really one of the prime leverage points. And so one of the seven chapters in our book is all about cities and how to make them greener and better places to live. Another thing that I think we've really come to understand is that there has been a tendency, I think, for those of us who really care a lot about sustainability, to either reject technology or, in a handful of cases, just, you know, unthinkingly embrace it. And I think that one of the things that we've really found is that there is no sustainability that's not a high-tech sustainability at this point. We need to be better at designing things, better at controlling things, better at measuring them and reducing waste and energy use and so forth. And those things require technological breakthroughs. In addition, technology properly applied can help us in our day-to-day lives live in a much more green fashion. The more information we have about what we're doing, the easier it is to live sustainably. However, we're also recognizing that not every use of a technology is good, and that there are limits and wise precaution that needs to be taken. And we, in fact, embrace in the book the precautionary principle, if you know what that is, the idea that we ought to presume that harm might come from something, and then backstep from there to prove that it is not, in fact, harmful. So there's this balance that we're finding of being skeptical of technology and wary of its possible downsides while embracing at every turn technologies that have proven themselves to work. And I think that's a new thing in the sustainability movement too, is this idea that, you know, it's bright green. We're looking for, you know, a high-tech, prosperous urban life that itself is sustainable, rather than juxtaposing progress, technology, urbanization against some ideal of sustainability.
In your book, you also mention using holistic approaches to dealing with problems. Could you give a few examples of that approach and how it's worked?
Sure. I think that one of the things that's been really exciting is that in the last 10 years, people working in a number of different fields have started to realize that their concerns overlap and, in fact, their solutions overlap. So, for example, one of the things that we've discovered is in many places where extreme conflict and even genocide is occurring or has occurred, resource scarcity is part of the problem. And it turns out that in many places where you have friction between ethnic groups or political groups, part of what's going on, especially in Africa, is that there's conflict over water or other resources. And it turns out that if you get people sitting down at the table and talking ahead of time about how they want to manage those resources, that people actually have a much lower likelihood of going to war over them. And that the resource itself, you know, let's say a river, the water in a river is actually managed more effectively, more sustainably. So these folks who are coming at it both from a peacemaking standpoint and from a sustainability standpoint have realized that environmental peacemaking, as they call it, is a critical tool for both protecting natural systems, but also avoiding serious violence.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Alex Steffen, executive editor of worldchanging.com and editor of the book, World Changing, A User's Guide to the 21st Century. What are some of the special contributions toward sustainability being made by the Global South?
Well, I think it's really exciting to be alive right now because we're hitting a point where, in many ways, the most innovative answers are all coming out of the Global South. Some of us haven't caught on to it very well yet, but there are a number of just really, truly phenomenal models. You could look at Bogota and look at the way in which a series of good mayors there has really transformed a city that was known for squalor and violence into a place that's very livable, much safer, where people have access to much better basic services. And they did it really almost all through moral exhortation, by being clever about how they asked people to change their lives. So, for example, one of the mayors recorded a series of advertisements, of public service advertisements, asking people to reduce their water use. One of them was he did it in the shower, turned off the water while he was in the shower, gave the PSA, turned the water back on and rinsed off. Or, for example, they did the Night of Women, where they asked all the men to stay home, watch the kids and so forth, and they asked all the women to come out to make the point that it needed to be a safe city for women if it was going to be a good city. And, you know, some hundreds of thousands of women turned out, had a huge party in the streets, and since then the culture around how women are treated on the street has changed. So I think those things are great examples. There are also great examples in terms of planning and actual, building and technology. For example, you have Curitiba in Brazil, which has pioneered the idea of bus rapid transit and really built one of the most amazing systems in the world. You have rainwater harvesting systems in India and South Africa that are phenomenal, that actually capture a lot of people's drinking water off the runoff off their roofs, something that we aren't doing here. We still take perfectly great rainwater and make it into a problem by dumping it into our sewers. Another set of phenomenal examples is coming out of China, which has massive problems and is really one of the key tipping points for things going well or poorly as a whole. But China has started to pursue some models of urban development that are really exciting, at least as test cases. For example, Dongtan, which is a new development outside of Shanghai being built by the architecture firm Arup, is going to be probably, at this point, the most sustainable human settlement in the world. And it's being built in a place that most of us, I think, tend to think of as somehow lagging behind us. So I think that we need to be very aware of what is happening in the developing world and what's happening when ideas from the developed world and technology from the developed world meets ideas from the global south, because that's really where a lot of the fruitful discussion is happening.
Could you focus also on the ways in which the global south is leapfrogging or skipping outmoded methods, embracing new ones directly?
Sure. Leapfrogging is this idea that you don't need, in today's day and age, you don't need to go through all the previous stages of development to get to the latest stage. That, for example, if you want to make a call in Africa, right, you don't have to invent the telegraph, lay down copper wire, break up AT&T, and so forth. All you need to do is build a cell phone tower and get a cell phone, right? And so there are, for years and years and years, people were saying that, half of mankind has never made a telephone call. That's not true anymore. In fact, in Africa, according to my friend Ethan Zuckerman, now it's about 1 in 10 people owns a cell phone, which means that almost everybody has access to a phone because people share phones, people rent them, et cetera. So what you've seen is a country that has almost no landline telephones, that has almost no telephones as we thought of them 10 years ago, 15 years ago, but actually has access to telephony for almost every person there. In a number of arenas, cities and communities in the global south are leaping forward to the latest technology and leaping over the technologies that it took to get to that technology. And that's true of everything from communications technology. For example, public Wi-Fi is spreading very quickly in Africa, much more quickly than it's spreading in North America. It's true as well of energy technologies. There are a great number of places where they have no electrical grid, so it makes no sense to go build a coal-fired power plant and string wires all across the country. If you want electricity, you get a solar panel and hook it up directly. Same thing is true for water. In many places, it makes no sense to try and build a huge water treatment plant that can cover a city because they just don't have the resources. So they're becoming innovative about how you get water. Maybe you use rainwater, harvesting. Maybe you use some of the new purification techniques, so on and so forth. People are grabbing on to the best ideas that are available now and using them even when supposedly more advanced, quote-unquote, countries such as the United States have yet to do so themselves.
Could you now talk about some of the novel ways that human innovations are being spread more equitably throughout the world?
Well, yeah. One of the things that we've found in the sustainability movement now is we're understanding that a lot of things that we didn't used to think of as being important to sustainability are actually fundamental to the success of the movement as a whole, to our success in building a one planet civilization, if you will. One of those things is transparency. We've learned that in places where the government is corrupt, where the rule of law does not prevail, where violence is allowed to sway political decisions, or just where money talks and talks in private, all of the things that we want to see happen are much more difficult. And conversely, in places where things are open and where they're transparent and sunlight shines on public decisions, better decisions get made. It gets easier to do the kinds of things that we're advocating, whether you're talking about protecting ecosystems, using less energy, or promoting human health. A second thing that relates very much to transparency is this idea of openness in the sense of open source and free accessibility. And one of the things that we're really seeing now is a global movement of people who want to change the way that we think about copyright and other intellectual property in order to allow people to more freely innovate and share. So we're seeing phenomenal things like open source software, which is spreading rapidly across the world. If you were to take out the United States, there would already be more open source operating systems in use than Microsoft operating systems. But there's also things like the Creative Commons license, which allows you to retain some control over the things that you create, but freely share them under certain circumstances. So if you can, for example, use my photos, as long as you aren't asking people to pay for them or changing them, you can use them any way you want. Or the developing nations Creative Commons license, which says, if you live in one of the following countries, say a European or American country, you have to pay me for my design. But if you live in Africa, you don't have to pay me for my design as long as you're not selling it back here. you know, which is another way of allowing people to share ideas about how to make things better. And those two forces of transparency and openness are really helping to spread very rapidly a number of ideas that previously would have been locked up in sort of commercial proprietary systems. And what we're finding is that if you give people access to the actual tools, the actual designs, the actual ways of making things, people are smart and they'll do things we never expected. So you now have, for example, Brazil becoming a leader in open source software. You have South Africa becoming a leader in this idea of open source medicine, of nonprofit medicine. You have South-South science. So you have scientists from India and from Africa and from South America and from China cooperating to do medical and agricultural and technological advancements that benefit people who normally are left out of scientific advancements. So it's really a phenomenally interesting time.
What pointers do you have for individuals in helping them decide whether a particular course of action they have decided upon will really make a difference?
I think that we have to look at the big picture. I think the most important thing we can do is change our thinking. It's far more important than any other sort of specific action we're going to make. If we start to think about ourselves as being tied into a number of systems and as having a footprint, an ecological footprint, right? Because of our use of those systems and our behaviors within those systems, then we start to see that, in fact, first of all, our footprints are all too large and we need to shrink them. But we also start to see the goal being to be clever enough to either change those systems, work with different systems, or do different things when working with those systems so that you actually reduce your footprint rather than just doing things because somebody told us they're good. My personal feeling is that if we're doing things that take a lot of effort in order to be a little greener, we're doing it wrong. That what we should do is put our effort and our money and our other abilities to have influence behind things that actually make big shifts. And often, because of the nature of our system here in the U.S., those shifts have to be communal in some way or shape or form. They involve dealing with a different business, you know, or changing a system so that other possibilities are available within it. For example, it is now possible to buy green power, right, through the local utilities. That's something that needed to be pushed for. People needed to do that. Now that it's there, we can actually make a more responsible choice that is an effective choice that makes a real difference. And so we should do that. Similarly, when you're talking about, you know, most of us have environmental impact that's highly related to our energy use, and particularly here in Seattle, to the amount of time we spend driving. And we could and should be pushing for changes in our transportation system, in our land use rules, but also trying to support other kinds of alternatives, whether that's just, you know, deciding that you're going to live close enough to your work that you don't need to drive every day, or joining a car sharing co-op so that you can have perhaps only one or no cars in your household, because we know that every car itself, even before it's driven, takes an enormous amount of energy and materials to make, right? Half of the energy that a car will ever use in its lifetime are used to make it. So if you can have one less car, you're using a lot fewer, your impact shrinks immediately. So there's lots of things that people can do, but what we really encourage at World Changing is for people to get a sense themselves of their own role and make a decision themselves about what they're best able to do. You know, we say quite frequently, you know, follow your geek, right? You know, that if you're into gardening, like make your yard organic and full of native plants and a sanctuary for birds and butterflies and stop watering in the summers and do all the good things that you can do in a yard. If you're a home repair person, you know, make sure your house is insulated, use green remodeling techniques, use more sustainable materials, really make your home a showcase, right? If you're a person who likes policy, go out there and find out what the best available policies are and bring them and advocate for them and make them happen. If you're somebody in media, portray what the possibilities are. Whatever your background is, whoever you are, there's a way for you to become a real lever in making change. But you've got to understand the system that you're trying to change before you can do that.
You just returned last month from a national book tour. What kind of response are you getting to your book?
It's been mind-boggling, frankly. We had overflow crowds everywhere we went. We had, hundreds of people showing up to events. We had 800 in New York City. We had 700 in Toronto. We had 500 in LA and San Francisco. We had these just gigantic crowds, and the book itself is selling extraordinarily well. I would like to believe that it's because we're rock stars and everybody loves us, but I think what it really is just that there's a moment right now that's happening that a lot of people are realizing that the problems are very real and very dire and very present, that we used to think of an environmental crisis as being a distant thing that would affect our kids or our grandkids. And we now know that it's right here on top of us, that the Stern Review from the UK government, which just came out a couple months ago, said that climate change will drain the world economy of 5 to 20% of its value by the end of this decade, and could over time become the greatest economic disaster since the Great Depression. We're starting to see the consequences of these things, and we're also starting to see the connection that we have with people elsewhere, whether you're talking 9/11 or Katrina or whatever. We're starting to see that we are tied into the rest of the world in a way that we have ignored for decades. And I think that both of those things are combining with a real sort of can-do spirit and frankly, I think a bit of a generational change, and leading a lot of people to want to be part of the solution.
What trends do you see towards sustainability in this new year of 2007?
Well, the most hopeful trend that I see in the U.S. is the beginnings of an acknowledgement of the magnitude of the crisis that is already here, the magnitude that's undisputed. And I hope the beginnings of an understanding that we need to think in really radically innovative ways about solutions if we're going to tackle those problems. That, you know, climate change is not something that's going to happen to our grandkids, although it will still be happening when they're around. It's happening already right now. But similarly, it's not enough to just occasionally throw a can in the recycling bin. You know, that we need to actually rethink pretty much everything about our entire material civilization if we're going to make it. That we need to go through a period of reform and innovation and change that's unlike anything we've seen in this country for probably 250 years, you know, since the revolution itself. And I think that more people are starting to get that both the change is necessary and the change is possible, and if we do it right, the change will actually lead to a society that will be better for most of us to live in.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, other than, of course, buy the book, World Changing, A User's Guide for the 21st Century, makes a lovely post-holiday gift. But other than that, obviously, really what I would say is this, that each of us has an avenue available in front of us to becoming a person who is really part of building a brighter and greener future. And no one else can tell you what that avenue is. Each of us has to find it ourselves. And so use the resources that are out there. World changing, sure, but there's also a lot of other really valuable, phenomenal things out there. Use them, think about your own life, and think about how you can become a person who's building that future today.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Alex.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Alex Steffen, executive editor of WorldChanging.com and editor of the book, World Changing, A User's Guide to the 21st Century, published in 2006 by Abrams, an imprint of Harry N. Abrams, Inc. For more information, check on the web at www.worldchanging.com. Again, that's worldchanging.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.